her daughter. No member of the Explorers Club is allowed to be unhappy on a Saturday adventure. New rule. Who made you president? Loretta said.
I did.
Aunt giggled.
Ma, me for president. Ma, me for president.
He chanted, marching on the soft, wet grass. Elsa pressed a hand to her heart. It is such an honor. Why, I never expected such a thing. A woman president. Loretta finally laughed, and the mood lifted. They turned onto the main road and walked all the way to Welty. By the time they reached the quaint little town with its cotton bowl welcome sign, the fog had been burned away by a surprisingly warm sun. The mountains in the distance showed a new layer of snow. The trees along Main Street displayed their autumn finery. "Wait here," Elsa said outside the Welty Farms office. Inside, she got into line and waited her turn to cash her chit. "Here you go," the man at the desk said, taking her chit worth $20 and giving her $18 in exchange. Elsa rolled the money as tightly as she could, mentally calculating the total of their savings. It seemed like a lot now, but she knew it wouldn't be much by February. But she wasn't going to think of that today. She returned to the street, where the children stood beneath a lamppost, waiting. It was one of those sharp-as-a-tack moments when she saw them. Loretta, thin as a chicken bone in a threadbare dress and shoes that didn't fit and long, raggedly growing-out hair. Aunt, scrawny and with dirty hair no matter how hard Elsa tried to keep him clean, still, thankfully, fitting into Buster's old shoes. Elsa forced a smile as she walked out to meet them. Taking Aunt's hand, she headed down Main Street, where the shops were opening for the day. She smelled coffee and freshly baked pastries as she passed the diner, and the familiar smell of baled hay and bags of grain as they passed the feed store. There it was, the destination she'd had in mind when they left the camp this morning. Betty Ann's Beauty Shop. Elsa had seen the pretty little salon every time she came to town, seen well-dressed women coming out with stylish hair. Elsa walked toward the salon. It was housed in an old-fashioned bungalow with a fenced yard out front. Loretta stopped, shook her head.
No, Mom, you know how they'll treat us.
Elsa knew better than to make another hollow promise. She also knew that no matter how often you were knocked down, you had to keep getting up. She tightened her hold on Aunt's hand and opened the gate. Loretta wasn't following. Elsa knew it and kept going. Come on, Loretta, be brave. Elsa and Aunt walked up to the front door, and Elsa opened it. A bell jangled overhead. Inside, the salon filled what had once been the bungalow's parlor. There were two pink chairs stationed in front of mirrors. Cords lay snaked on the floor, gathered up at a machine in the corner. Framed photographs of movie stars lined the pink walls. A middle-aged woman in a white frock coat stood in the center of the salon holding a broom. She looked thoroughly, almost stubbornly modern, with waved, chin-length, platinum-dyed hair and pencil-thin eyebrows. Her Clara Bow lips were painted a bright French red. Oh, she said at the sight of them huddled together. Loretta slipped in beside Elsa, took hold of her hand, and tugged it.
Let's go, Mom.
Elsa took a deep breath.
This is my daughter, Loretta. She's 13 and about to start school on Monday after a season of picking cotton. She expects to be teased because, well...
Loretta groaned beside her.
Let me speak to my husband, the beautician said, and left the room. She's probably calling the police, Loretta said. She'll say we're vagrants, or worse.
A few moments later, the woman returned to the beauty parlor and faced them, pulling a comb out of her pocket.
I'm Betty Ann, she said,
moving toward them, her high heels clicking on the hardwood floor. She came to a stop in front of Loretta, close but not too close. Please, Elsa thought, tightening her hold on Loretta's hand. Be kind to my girl.
At the same moment, a large man in a brown suit came into the parlor from another room, carrying a big cardboard box.
"This is my husband, Ned," Betty Ann said.
"I understand," Elsa said.
"You and Ned want us to leave. Go back to our kind."
Ned pulled the hat off of his head.
"No, ma'am. We came here in 30. It was tough to make a living, but nothing like it is now."
He offered her the box.
"Here's some coats and sweaters and such. Winter can be cold here. There's a shower in our bathroom, hot water. Why don't you all help yourselves? A hot shower and new clothes can be a mighty bit of help in hard times."
Betty Ann smiled kindly at Loretta.
"And I see a girl who needs a new hairstyle for her first day of school. Lord knows 13 is hard enough without all of this."
Betty Ann gave Loretta an appraising look.
"You're a real beauty, doll. Let me work my magic."
23. Loretta sat in the tufted velvet chair and stared at her reflection in the mirror. Betty Ann had cut Loretta's black hair in a precise line along her chin and then coaxed it into waves that cascaded down from a deep side part. Her face, scrubbed clean with scented soap, was deeply tanned from work in the cotton fields. A new purple dress accentuated the startling blue of Loretta's eyes, and Betty Ann had talked Elsa into letting Loretta put a little pale pink color on her lips.
"I forgot what I looked like," Loretta said, touching the silky tips of her hair.
Betty Ann stood behind her.
"You may be the prettiest girl I've ever seen."
She turned.
"Elsa, your turn."
Loretta hated to get out of the chair. It felt magical, a portal to a what-if world where ditch dwellers turned into princesses. Her legs were a little shaky, to be honest. In the mirror, she'd seen more than her face. She'd seen the girl she'd been before all of this, a dreamer, a believer, someone who would go places. How had she forgotten all of that? It gave her a newfound or refound hope, but it fed the anger in her, too. She thanked Betty Ann and moved away from the mirror. Mom touched her shoulder as they changed places.
"Say, is this your natural hair color?"
Betty Ann said as Elsa sat down.
"It's beautiful."
Loretta backed away. Without a glance at Aunt, who was on the floor playing with a toy car, she went outside. Even the air out here smelled different now. She straightened to her full height, realizing all at once how life in the fields had hunched and diminished her. She'd spent months trying to be a cog in a wheel, unseen. No more. She strode confidently forward in the new-to-her dress with its Peter Pan collar. Her scuffed brown shoes hardly bothered her when coupled with lacy white socks. She found the library on Pepper Street, set back from the town, on a pretty grass lot with an American flag flapping from a white pole out front. A library. Magic. She opened the door and walked right in, standing tall, the girl she'd been raised to be. A girl who believed in education and dreamed of being a reporter, or a novelist. Something interesting, anyway. The first thing she noticed was the smell of books. She inhaled deeply and felt transported for a moment to Lonesome Tree. In her bedroom, light on, reading. Home.
"May I help you?"
"Yes, please. I would love to find a book to read."
The librarian came out from around the desk. She was a sturdy woman with gray pin curls and black-rimmed glasses.
"Do you have a library card?"
"No."
Loretta was ashamed to admit it. She'd always had a library card in Texas.
"We are new to the state."
"Well."
The librarian smiled kindly.
13?
"Yes, ma'am."
"In school?"
"Yes, ma'am."
The librarian nodded.
"Come with me."
She led Loretta through the library stacks to a large wooden student's table that was strewn with newspapers.
"You can sit here. Let me find you something."
Loretta sat down at the oak desk, which had a lamp on it.
She couldn't help flicking the light on and off and on again, marveling at the magic of electricity on demand. The librarian returned with a book.
"What's your name?"
"Loretta Martinelli."
"I'm Mrs. Quistorf. You come back for your card, but I'll trust you with this for now."
She set down a worn copy of The Secret of the Old Clock. Loretta touched the book, lifted it to her face, and inhaled the remembered scent that made her think of reading at night, with Stella after school, listening to Daddy telling her bedtime stories. Like a flower that had been sucked dry in a drought and felt the first drop of spring rain, Loretta felt herself revive.
"Do you have one I could take to my brother? He's 8, and maybe one for my mom? I'll bring them back, I promise."
Mrs. Quistorf eyed her assessingly and finally smiled.
"Miss Martinelli, I believe you are my kind of girl."
That night, after the children were asleep, Elsa swept the tent floor again and rearranged the collection of found fruit cartons that had become their pantry. They had sugar, flour, bacon, beans, canned milk, rice, and butter. A veritable feast. But even as the depression had worsened, food prices had gone up. 5 gallons of kerosene cost $1. 2 pounds of butter cost 50 cents. 6 pounds of rice cost nearly $0.50. It was terrifying how fast it added up. And today she'd spent 75 cents on haircuts for the three of them. She hoped she didn't regret it come winter. Hefting the box of clothes she'd gotten today, she ducked out of the tent and walked over to see Jean, who sat in a chair by the wood stove, darning socks by lantern light. Jeb and the boys had taken the truck, hoping to find autumn work in the grape fields. No one expected them to find it this late in the year, though.
"Hey, Jean,"
Elsa said, coming out of the dark and into the lantern's pale light. She and the children had chosen what fit them from the box of clothes and saved the rest for the Deweys.
"Elsa, you look so pretty."
Elsa felt her cheeks heat up as she set down the box of clothes.
"Betty Ann tried."
Jean touched the wooden bucket nearest her with her toe.
"Sit down."
Elsa settled herself on the bucket, ignoring the way it pinched into her bony buttocks. Lord, those beauty salon seats had felt heavenly.
"Why do you say things like that?"
Elsa looked through the box of clothes until she found what she was looking for. Her fingers felt soft, soft wool.
"Like what?" "Has no one ever said you were pretty?"
Elsa stopped rooting through the clothes and looked up.
"I love a friend who lies." "I'm not lying." "I'm not good with compliments, I guess,"
Elsa said, smoothing the silky chin-length hair back from her face. She pulled out a soft, lavender-blue baby blanket and held it out to Jean.
"Look at this."
Jean took the blanket, stared down at it.
"He was dancing up a storm yesterday,"
Jean said, putting a hand on her rounded belly. Elsa knew Jean prayed every day to feel movement in her womb, and that with every movement she felt both joy and fear.
"I had a dream last night. I had a job in a diner. I was serving apple pie to women who still wore hats that matched their dresses."
Jean nodded.
"I reckon we all have that dream."
Winter hit the San Joaquin Valley hard, a frightening combination of bad weather and no work. Day after day, rain fell from steel wool-colored skies, fat drops clattering on the automobiles and tin can shacks and tents clustered along the ditch bank. Puddles of mud formed and wandered, became trenches. Brown splatter marks discolored everything. Elsa mourned every dollar spent, counting and recounting her money on a daily basis. She was frugal, but even so, her savings diminished. She hated that she and the children had had no choice but to buy galoshes this month. There had been nothing in their sizes at the Salvation Army or the giveaway box at the Presbyterian Church. By late December, her savings had dwindled enough that she lived in a constant state of fear.
Cotton hadn't earned them enough to last through the winter. She understood that now. She needed help to feed her children. It was as simple, as heartbreaking, as that. She couldn't get money from the state until April, but she could get food from the feds. It was better than standing in line at a soup kitchen, bowl and spoon in hand, but she knew that could be her future if she wasn't careful. Honestly, she'd be doing it now if she hadn't heard that the supply at the soup kitchens was stretched to the limit. She didn't want to take free food out of the mouths of people who had no other choice, not while she still had some money.
"It ain't nothing to be ashamed of," Jean said when Elsa told her.
They were standing in Elsa's tent, having a cup of coffee together in the relative quiet of mid-morning. Loretta and Aunt had left for school hours ago. Rain thumped on the canvas, rattled the poles.
"Really?"
Elsa said, looking at her friend. They both knew better. It was something to be ashamed of. Americans weren't supposed to take handouts from the government. They were supposed to work hard and succeed on their own.
"None of us got a choice," Jean said. "You don't get much, beans and rice, but every morsel matters."
That was the truth of it. Elsa nodded.
"Well, I won't get help standing here wishing life were different." "Ain't it the truth?" Jean said.
The women exchanged a smile. Jean left the tent, closed the flaps behind her. Elsa buttoned up her hooded coat and stepped into her oversized galoshes and began the walk into Welty. In this weather, it was slow going. Nearly an hour later, splattered with mud, bedraggled by rain, Elsa stepped into the long line of people in front of the Federal Relief Office. She stood in line for 2 more hours. By the time she reached the interior of the office, she was shivering violently.
"Elsinor Martinelli," she said to the young man seated at a desk in the small office.
He ran through a tin box full of red cards, pulled one out.
"Martinelli, registered arrival in the state on April 26, 1935. 2 children, 1 woman, no husband."
Elsa nodded.
"We've been here almost 8 months.
2 pounds of beans, 4 cans of milk, a loaf of bread. Next."
He stamped the card.
"Come back in 2 weeks.
"That's supposed to last us 2 weeks, she said.
The young man looked up.
"You see how many people need help?" he said. "We're overwhelmed. There just isn't enough money. The Salvation Army has a soup kitchen on 7th.
Elsa picked up her box of commodities and settled it uncomfortably in her arms. With a tired sigh, she stepped back out into the rain.
"Join us! Raise your voices! Workers of the Valley, unite!"
Elsa looked over at the man standing at the corner, shouting. He wore a long, dark-colored duster and a hood. Rain slashed at him. He raised a fist for emphasis.
"Unite! Don't let them make you afraid! Come to the Workers' Alliance meeting!"
Elsa saw how people moved away from him, drew back. None of them could afford being seen with a communist. A police car rolled up, lights flashing. 2 officers got out and grabbed the man and started beating him.
"You see this?"
the communist shouted.
"This is in America! The coppers are hauling me away for my ideas!"
The cops shoved him into the squad car and drove away. Elsa resettled the box of commodities in her arms and began the long walk back to the camp. It was late afternoon when she reached the field. There were almost 1,000 people living here now, more than 4 times the number that had been here when they had arrived. Elsa splashed through ankle-deep mud toward her tent. A few people were out and about, scavenging for anything that they could use. She stopped at the Dewey's tent.
"Anyone home?"
The flaps were opened by Lucy. Elsa saw the whole family, all 6 of them, gathered inside. Jeb and the boys had been as unable to find work as everyone else. Jean smiled tiredly, her hand resting on her big belly. The buttons of her dress gaped. One was missing.
"Hey, Elsa. How'd it go?"
Elsa reached into the box and withdrew two cans of milk, as well as a few slices of bread from the loaf she'd been given. It wasn't much, and yet it was. The two families shared whatever good fortune came their way.
"Here you go," she said, offering the food.
"Thank you," Jean said, giving her an understanding look. Elsa returned to her own tent and ducked inside. The floor was mud now. No wonder people were getting sick. Ant sat on the mattress they all shared, doing his homework. Loretta sat on an apple crate, sewing a black button onto the purple dress she'd gotten at the beauty salon. At Elsa's arrival, she looked up.
"How was it?"
"Fun." Elsa's hands were so cold she almost dropped the box. Loretta got up and wrapped a blanket around Elsa, who sat down gingerly on the edge of the mattress.
"You should have seen how many people there were in line, Loretta," Elsa said. "The soup kitchen line was twice as long." "Hard times," Loretta said woodenly. It was what they always said.
"What would Tony and Rose say if they knew we were living on the dole?"
"They'd say Aunt needed the milk,"
Loretta said. Elsa knew now how Tony had felt when his land died. There was a deep and abiding shame that came with asking for handouts. Poverty was a soul-crushing thing, a cave that tightened around you, its pinprick of light closing a little more at the end of each desperate, unchanged day. Christmas morning dawned bright and clear, the first dry day in nearly a week. Elsa woke to blissful quiet. She had slept in. They all had. These days, there was no reason to rise before dawn. There was no work to be found, and school was closed for the holiday. She got out of bed slowly, moving like an old woman. Indeed, she felt like one. The combination of cold, hunger, and fear had aged her. All she wanted to do was climb back in bed with her kids and cuddle under the covers and sleep. It was her only escape. But she knew how dangerous escape could be. Survival took grit and courage and effort. It was too easy to give in. No matter how afraid she had to teach her children every day how to survive. She grabbed the water jug and went outside to make coffee. The camp wakened with her. People came out of their tents, blinking mole-like at the unexpected sunlight. Folks smiled and waved. Someone was playing a fiddle. A banjo joined in. Someone somewhere began to sing. Elsa wrapped a blanket around her shoulders and followed the music to a group gathered by the ditch, now swollen with fast-moving brown water. She found Jean and Midge standing together beside a tree. There were men sitting on rocks or fallen trees along the bank, playing the instruments they'd brought across the country. Women stood with buckets they'd filled and set down. Jean and Midge began to sing, "Will the circle be unbroken?" Others joined in, "By and by, Lord, by and by." Elsa felt the music rise up in her. In it, she heard the best of her past. Church services with Rose and the family, Tony playing his fiddle, box suppers, even the one time Rafe had danced with her at Pioneer Days. She went back to the tent and wakened the children and hustled them out to the bank. The three of them stood alongside Jean and Midge. Within moments, Jeb and the Dewey kids showed up. A crowd formed around them. Elsa held her children's hands. They stood on the muddy bank and looked up to the bright heavens and sang hymns and Christmas songs, and by the end, none of them cared that the local churches denied them entry, or that their clothes were ragged and dirty, or that Christmas dinner would be small. They found strength in each other. Elsa and Jean looked at each other as they sang the words, "Be unbroken." When the men finally stopped playing, people looked each other in the eye for the first time in weeks, wished each other a Merry Christmas. Elsa held on to her children's hands as they walked back to the tent. Loretta stoked the fire, then poured two cups of coffee and handed one to Elsa. Aunt dragged a stool and two fruit crates outside. They sat in front of the tent, close to the stove's warmth. They'd made a tree out of nailed-together tin cans and kindling and decorated it with whatever they could find, utensils, hair ribbons, strips of cloth. Elsa pulled a small, muddied, crumpled envelope out of her pocket and opened the letter that had arrived last week, general mail at the post office.
"A letter from Grandma and Grandpa," Aunt said.
Elsa unfolded it and read aloud.
"My dearest daughter and grandchildren, another dust storm hit this week, and after that, a cold snap. It has been a tiresomely cold winter, I must tell you. We are envious of your California warmth. Mr. Pavlov tells us you must have seen a palm tree by now, and perhaps the ocean. What grand sights. Your grandfather thinks the soil conservation program shows promise. Much of what we planted was hit hard by the continuing drought, but after a light rain this month, we see a little sprouting. Still, thanks to the Virgin, the well is working. We have enough water for the household and the chickens, so we carry on, hoping again for a crop. The 10 cents per acre we get from the government has kept us afloat. Your last letter spoke of cotton picking. I must say, it is hard to imagine you in the fields, Elsa, but more power to you all for thriving in these difficult times. Hard times don't last. Love does. We are sending along small gifts for our beloved grandchildren so that they remember us well. With love, Rose and Anthony." Elsa pulled 2 pennies out of the envelope and handed one to each of them. Aunt's eyes lit up.
"Candy money!" he cried.
"And there are more gifts in my suitcase," Elsa said, warming her hands around her cup of coffee. "Because I know a young man who likes to snoop."
Aunt wheeled around and went into the tent and came out with 2 packages, one wrapped in newspaper, the other in cloth. Aunt ripped his open. Elsa had made him a handsome vest from the seat fabric of an automobile that had been abandoned in the camp, and she'd bought him a Hershey's chocolate bar. Aunt's eyes rounded. He knew the candy bar cost 5 cents, a fortune.
"Chocolate!"
He peeled back the wrapper slowly, revealing a sharp brown corner, which he bit off in a mouse-like nibble, savoring. Loretta opened her gift. Elsa had repaired Loretta's shoes, used tire rubber to fashion a new set of soles, which would last longer and be more comfortable than cardboard. Beneath the shoes lay Loretta's brand new library card and the hidden staircase. Loretta looked up.
"You went back? In the rain?"
"Mrs. Quistorf picked that book out for you. That card, though, that's the real gift. It can take you anywhere, Loretta."
Loretta's fingers traced the card reverently. Elsa knew that a library card, a thing they'd taken for granted all of their lives, meant there was still a future, a world beyond this struggle. Aunt bounced up and down on the stool in excitement.
"Can we give Mommy her present now?"
Loretta walked over to the truck and pulled out a small package wrapped in newsprint.
"Open it,"
Aunt said, bouncing to his feet. Elsa carefully unwrapped the gift, not wanting to rip the newspaper or lose the strips of cloth that bound it all. Everything mattered these days. Inside lay a slim, leather-bound journal full of blank paper. The first few pages of the book had been ripped away, and the cover was water-damaged. Several pencils, sharpened down to stubs, rolled out and plopped onto the ground. Loretta looked at her.
"I know you have stuff you need to say, but we're kids, so you stay quiet. I thought maybe writing it down would make you feel better." "I thought that too," Aunt said. "I got the pencils from school, all by myself."
The journal reminded Elsa of who she'd once been, the girl with the bad heart who had read books and dreamed of going away to college to study literature. She'd dreamed of one day writing.
"Do you have some hidden talent of which we are all unaware?"
Elsa hated that she heard her father's voice now, of all moments, at this time when her love for her children almost bowled her over, and she thought, even in the midst of all this hardship and failure, I have raised good children, kind, caring, loving people.
I'll write something, Elsa said.
Will you let us read it, Mommy?
Aunt asked.
Maybe someday.
1936. One thing was left, as clear and perfect as a drop of rain, the desperate need to stand together. They would rise and fall, and in their falling, rise again. Sonora Babb, whose names are unknown. 24. On the last day of January, a cold front moved into the valley and stayed for 7 days. The ground turned hard. Fog lay for hours every morning. There was still no work. Their savings decreased, but Elsa knew they were the lucky ones. They'd saved cotton money, and there were only 3 of them. The Deweys had 6 mouths to feed, and soon it would be 7. The migrants who had just arrived in the state, most of them with nothing, were trying to survive on federal relief, paltry amounts of food handed out every 2 weeks. They lived on flour and water pancakes and fried dough. Elsa could see the ravages of malnutrition on their faces. Now it was past supper time, which had been a cup of watery beans and a slice of skillet bread for each of them. Elsa sat on an overturned bucket by the wood-burning stove with the metal box open on her lap. Aunt sat beside her, taking his daily nibble off his Christmas Hershey's chocolate bar. Loretta was in the tent, rereading The Hidden Staircase. Elsa counted their money again.
Elsa, it's time!
She heard Jean shout her name. Elsa stood up so fast she nearly upended the box of money. The baby. Aunt looked up.
What's wrong?
Elsa ran into the tent and hid the box of money. Loretta, she said, come with me.
Where?
Jean's having her baby. Elsa ran to the Deweys' tent. She found Lucy outside crying. Loretta, take the girls to our tent. Tell them to stay with Aunt and not to come back until you come to get them. Then come back to help me. Elsa entered the Deweys' dark, dank tent. A single lantern glowed, barely banishing the shadows. She saw gray lines in the dark, a pile of food stores, a makeshift wash basin. Jean lay on her side on a mattress on the floor, as still as a held breath. Elsa knelt beside the mattress.
Hey, she said, touching Jean's damp forehead. Where's Jeb?
Napomo, hoping to pick peas,
Jean panted.
Something ain't right, Elsa.
Not right. Elsa knew what that meant. Every woman who'd lost a child did. A mother's instinct was strong at a time like this. Loretta came into the tent.
Help me get her to her feet, Elsa said to Loretta.
Together, they got Jean upright. Jean leaned heavily on Elsa.
I'm taking you to the hospital, Elsa said.
No sense.
It's not nonsense. This isn't a child with a cough or a fever, Jean. This is an emergency.
They won't.
Jean's face tightened as another contraction hit. Elsa and Loretta got Jean settled in the passenger seat of the truck.
Watch the kids, Loretta.
Elsa started the engine and hit the lights, and they were off, rattling down the muddy road, driving too fast.
Can't,
Jean said, clutching the armrest.
Take back!
Another contraction. Elsa turned into the hospital parking lot. The building glowed with expensive electrical lighting. Elsa slammed on the brakes.
Wait here, I'll get help.
She ran into the hospital, rushed down the hallway, and stopped at the desk.
My friend is having a baby.
The woman looked up, frowned, and then wrinkled her nose.
Yeah, I smell. Elsa said. I'm a dirty migrant, I get it, but my friend...
This hospital is for Californians. You know, the folks who pay taxes. For citizens, not vagrants who want to be taken care of.
Come on, be human, please.
You? Telling me to be human? Please, look at yourself. You women pop out babies like champagne corks. Find one of yours to help you.
The woman finally rose. Elsa saw how well-fed she was, how plump her calves were. She reached inside a drawer, pulled out a pair of rubber gloves.
I'm sorry, but rules are rules. I am allowed to give you these.
She held out the gloves.
Please, I'll scrub floors, clean bedpans, anything. Just help her.
If it's as dire as you say, why waste time begging with me?
Elsa snatched the gloves and ran back to the truck.
They won't help us, she said through gritted teeth as she climbed in. The good, God-fearing folk of California don't care about a baby's life, I guess.
Elsa drove as fast as she could back to camp, rage trapped inside of her, tightening her breathing.
Hurry, Elsa!
At the Dewey's tent, Elsa helped Jean into the dank interior.
Loretta!
Elsa shouted. Loretta ran into the tent, banged into Elsa.
Why are you back?
They turned us away.
You mean?
Go get water. Boil a lot of it.
When Loretta didn't move, Elsa snapped, Now! And Loretta ran out. Elsa lit a kerosene lamp and helped Jean to the mattress on the floor. Jean convulsed in pain, gritted her teeth to keep from crying out. Elsa knelt beside her, stroking her hair.
Go ahead and scream.
It's coming,
Jean said between pants.
Keep the kids away. Scissors in that box. And there's some string.
Another contraction. Elsa stared at Jean's writhing belly and knew she only had a few moments. Elsa ran back to her tent, ignoring the children, who looked at her with frightened eyes. There wasn't time to comfort them now. She grabbed a stack of saved newspapers and ran back to Jean's tent, where she laid the newspapers down on the dirt floor, grateful that they were relatively clean. Headlines flashed out at her. Typhoid outbreak in migrant camps. Elsa helped Jean roll onto the newspapers. Elsa then put on the gloves. Jean screamed.
Go ahead,
Elsa said, kneeling beside her. She stroked Jean's wet hair.
It's now!
Jean cried out. Elsa moved quickly, positioned herself between Jean's open legs. The top of the baby's head appeared, slimed and blue.
I see the head, Elsa said. Push, Jean! I'm too...
I know you're tired. Push!
Jean shook her head.
Push!
Elsa said. She looked up. Saw the fear in her friend's eyes.
I know,
Elsa said, understanding Jean's deep fear of this moment. Babies died in the best of circumstances, and these were the worst. They also lived in spite of all odds.
Push,
she said, meeting Jean's fear with a quiet hopefulness. The baby whooshed out in a stream of blood into Elsa's gloved hands.
Too tiny, spindly almost, smaller than a man's shoe.
Blue. Elsa felt a roar of anger move through her. No. She wiped the blood from the tiny face, cleaned out her mouth, begged the infant,
Breathe, baby girl.
Jean pushed up to her elbows. She looked too tired to breathe herself.
She ain't breathing,
she said softly. Elsa tried to help the baby breathe, mouth to mouth. Nothing. She smacked the tiny blue bum, said, Breathe! Nothing. Nothing. Jean pointed to a straw basket. In it was the soft lavender blanket. Elsa tied off the umbilical cord and cut it, then got slowly to her feet, weak, shaky. She wrapped up the tiny, still baby. As she offered the baby to Jean, tears blurred her vision.
A girl,
she said to Jean, who took her with a gentleness that broke Elsa's heart. Jean kissed the blue forehead.
I'm naming her Clea, after my mom,
Jean said. A name, the very essence of hope. the beginning of an identity handed down in love. Elsa backed away from the heartbreak of watching Jean whisper into the baby's blue ear. Outside, Elsa found Loretta pacing. Elsa looked at her daughter, saw the question, and shook her head.
Oh, no,
Loretta said, slumping her shoulders. Before Elsa could offer comfort, Loretta turned and disappeared into their tent. Elsa stood there, unmoving. That terrible, terrible image of a baby coming into the world on a crumpled newspaper over a dirt floor wouldn't go away. I'll name her Clea. How had Jean even been able to speak? Elsa felt tears rise up, overtake her. She cried as she hadn't cried since Rafe left her, cried until there was no moisture left inside of her, until she was as dry as the land they'd left behind. At a little past 10 o'clock that night, Loretta finished digging the small hole and dropped her shovel. They were far from camp, in an area surrounded by trees, a place as dark as the mood of the two women and one girl standing beneath them. Anger suffused Loretta, overwhelmed her. She felt it poisoning her from the inside out. She'd never felt its like before, not even when Daddy left them. She had to hold it inside her one breath at a time. If she let it go, she'd scream. And look at her mother, standing there, holding a dead baby in a clean lavender blanket, looking sad. Sad. The sight of it doubled Loretta's rage. This was no time to be sad. She fisted her hands at her side, but who was there to hit? Mrs. Dewey looked dazed and unsteady, ghostly. Mom knelt down and carefully placed the dead baby in the small grave and began to pray. Our Father.
Who the hell are you praying to?
Loretta snapped. She heard her mother sigh and slowly get to her feet. God has...
If you tell me he has a plan for us, I'll scream. I swear I will.
Loretta's voice broke. She felt herself start to cry, but she wasn't sad. She was furious.
He lets us live like this, worse than stray dogs.
Mom touched Loretta's face.
Baby star, Loretta. I lost your brother. Grandma Rose lost...
This isn't like that!
Loretta screamed.
You're a coward, staying here, making us stay here. Why?
Oh, Loretta.
Loretta knew she'd gone too far, had said too cruel a thing, but there was no stopping this rage, no slowing it.
If Daddy were here...
What? Mom said. What would he do?
He wouldn't let us live like this, burying dead babies in the dark, working our fingers to the bone, standing in line for 2 hours to get a can of milk from the government, watching people get sick around us.
He left us.
He left you. I should do the same. Get out of here before we're all dead.
Go then, Mom said. Run away. Be like him.
I might,
Loretta said.
Good. Go.
Mom bent down, picked up the shovel, began filling the grave with dirt. Scrape, thunk. In minutes, there would be nothing to show that a baby had been buried here. Loretta marched back through the squalid camp, past tents overfilled with people, past mangy dogs begging for scraps from folks who lived on scraps. She heard babies crying and people coughing. The Dewey tent was closed up, but Loretta knew the little girls were in there, waiting for their mother to comfort and reassure them. Words, lies, nothing would get better. She was done living like this. At her tent, she flung the flaps open, found Ant curled up on the mattress, his body as small as he could make it. They'd all learned how to sleep together on the too small bed. Her heart gave a hard ping at the sight of him. Loretta knelt beside the bed, ruffled his hair. He mumbled in his sleep.
I love you,
she whispered, kissing the hard bone of his cheek.
But I can't stay another second.
Aunt nodded in his sleep, murmured something. Loretta went to the small suitcase that held all of her ragged clothes and her beloved library card. From the food crate, she took 3 potatoes and 2 slices of bread and then opened the metal box that held their money. All they had in the world. Loretta felt a twinge of guilt. No. She wouldn't take much, just $2. It was her money as much as Mom's. God knew Loretta had worked for it. She carefully counted out the money and then scrounged for a piece of paper. She found a bit of crumpled newsprint. Smoothing it as best she could, she used one of Aunt's pencil stubs to write a note to her mother and aunt, leaving it beneath the coffee pot. She carried her suitcase to the tent flaps, looked back one last time, and walked away. She passed the truck, full of things they should have left behind. Aunt's baseball bat lay cocked against a mantel clock, neither of which they needed, but neither Loretta nor her mother had the heart to tell Aunt his baseball days were over before they'd begun. God knew if they'd ever need a mantel clock again. They would have packed differently if they'd known. Or maybe, if they'd known what waited for them in California, they'd have stayed in Texas. They shouldn't have left. Or maybe they should have gone farther. It was Mom's fault. She'd chosen to stop here, said, "We have to." Everything had gone wrong from then. From that first fatal lie. One night. Well, it had been a lot of nights, and Loretta was getting the hell out. Elsa and Jean stood together in the darkness, staring down, holding hands. Time fell away, passed in long swaths of silence between women who knew there were no words at a time like this. There was no marker here to commemorate the baby, nor markers to commemorate the others buried in this section of the camp. "We'd best get back," Elsa said at last, buttoning up her ill-fitting wool coat. "You're shivering." "I'll be along," Jean said. Elsa squeezed her friend's hand. With a sigh that felt drawn from deep in her tired bones, she carried the shovel back to camp and threw it in the back of the truck, where it landed with a clang. Thoughts of Loretta pushed their way in. Elsa should have comforted Loretta at the gravesite. What kind of mother snapped at a grieving 13-year-old? Loretta had seen too much loss. Elsa knew that. There must be words Elsa could find that would help. Elsa just had nothing left right now. She felt emptied by the baby's death. The last thing she could do was face her daughter's fury. Better to let a little time smooth over the edges. A night, at least. Tomorrow, the sun would shine, and Elsa would take Loretta aside and offer what comfort she could. Coward. "No," Elsa said out loud to reinforce the decision. She would not look away from this. She would hit it head on, try to comfort Loretta as best as she could. She lifted the tent flap and went inside. The quilts were tangled, but it was clear that Aunt was in bed alone. Loretta wasn't in the tent. Elsa went to the truck, banged on the side of the bed. "Loretta, are you in there?" She examined the bed, saw the boxes of goods they'd brought with them, things they'd thought they'd need, candlesticks, porcelain dishes, Aunt's baseball bat and mitt, a mantel clock. "Loretta," she said again, her voice spiking in worry when she saw that the cab was empty too. Elsa stepped back. "He left you. I should do the same. Get out of here before we're all dead. Go then. Go. Be like your father. Run away. Maybe I will. Good. Go." A chill moved through Elsa. She ran back into the tent. Loretta's suitcase was gone. So was her sweater and the blue wool coat she'd gotten at the salon. Elsa saw a note peeking out from beneath the coffee pot. Her hand shook as she reached for it. "Mom, I can't take it anymore. I'm sorry. I love you both." Elsa ran out of the tent and didn't stop running until there was a stitch in her side and her breathing was ragged. The main road stretched north and south. Which way would Loretta go? How could Elsa even guess? Elsa had told her 13-year-old daughter to go, to run away and be like a man who didn't want to be found, to go out into a world full of bindle stiffs walking the roads and riding the trains, gangs of desperate, angry men with nothing to lose who lurked like packs of wolves in the shadows. She screamed her daughter's name. The word rang out through the night and faded away. Loretta walked south until her shoe broke and her back ached, and still the empty road stretched in front of her, bathed in moonlight. How much farther to Los Angeles? She had always dreamed of finding her father, just bumping into him. But now, standing here alone on the side of the road, she understood what her mother had said to her once. He doesn't want to be found. How many roads were there in California, going how many directions to how many destinations? So what if her father dreamed of Hollywood? That didn't mean he'd gotten there, or that he'd stayed there. And how far had she walked? 3 miles? 4? She kept walking, determined not to turn around. She was not going to go back and admit she'd made a mistake by leaving. She couldn't stand this life anymore, period. But Aunt would wake up and miss her. He'd think he was easy to leave, that there was something wrong with him. Loretta knew that, because it was how she'd felt when Daddy had left. She didn't want to hurt her brother. She saw headlights in front of her, coming up the road. A truck rolled up to her and stopped. It was an old-fashioned truck, with a square wooden and glass cab that appeared to have been stuck on the truck's black chassis. The hinged windshield was open. The driver reached over and rolled down the passenger window. He was as old as Mom, with a face that was like most men's these days, sharp and bony. He needed to shave, but Loretta wouldn't call him bearded, just scruffy.
"What are you doing out here all by yourself? It's midnight."
"Nothing."
His gaze flicked down to her suitcase.
"You look like a girl who is running away."
"What do you care?"
"Where are your parents? It's dangerous out here."
"None of your business. Besides, I'm 16. I can go where I want."
"Yeah, kid. And I'm Errol Flynn. Where are you headed?"
"Anywhere but here."
He looked up the road. It was at least a minute before he looked at her again.
"There's a bus station in Bakersfield. I'm headed north. I can give you a lift. I just have to make a stop along the way."
"Thanks, mister."
Loretta tossed her suitcase in the back of the truck and climbed in. 25.
"I'm Jack Vallon," the man said.
"Loretta Martinelli."
He put the truck in gear and they drove north. The suspension on the truck was shot. The leather seat burped up and down at every bump. Loretta stared out the window. In the brief flash of their headlights or in the glare of billboards lit up by streetlights, she saw people camped on the side of the road and hobos walking with packs slung over their backs. They passed the school and the hospital and the squatters' camp, which lay shrouded in darkness. And then they were past the places Loretta knew, past the town of Welty. Out here, there was nothing but road.
"Hey, what do you have to do this late at night?"
she said. It occurred to her suddenly that she could have put herself in danger. The man lit a cigarette, exhaled a stream of blue-gray smoke through his open window.
"Same as you, I imagine."
"What do you mean?"
He turned. For the first time, she saw his entire face, the tanned roughness of it, the sharp nose and black eyes.
"You're running away from something, or someone."
"And you are, too?"
"Kid, if you aren't running away these days, you aren't paying attention." "But no, I'm not running."
He smiled in a way that made him almost handsome.
"I don't want to get caught out here, either."
"My dad did that."
"Did what?"
"Ran out in the middle of the night. Never came back."
"Well, that's a hell of a thing," he said at last. "What about your mom?"
"What about her?"
He turned onto a long dirt road. darkness. Loretta didn't see lights anywhere, just blackness. No houses, no streetlights, no other cars on the road.
Where are we going?
I told you I had a stop to make before I dropped you at the bus station.
Out here? In the middle of nowhere?
He let the truck roll to a stop.
I need your word, kid. You won't talk about this place, or me, or anything you see here.
They were in a huge grassy field. A barn stood alongside a dilapidated ranch house, both bathed in moonlight. A dozen or so cars and trucks were parked in the grass, their headlights off. Thin yellow lines in between the boards of the barn indicated that there was something going on inside.
No one listens to people like me,
Loretta said. She couldn't bring herself to say the word she meant. Okies.
If you don't give me your word, I'll turn around right now and drop you off on the main road.
Loretta looked at him. He was impatient with her, she could tell. A tick pulled at the corner of his eyes, but otherwise he appeared calm. He was waiting for her to decide, but he wouldn't wait long. She should tell him to turn around right now, take her back to the road. Whatever was going on in that barn this late at night couldn't be good, and grown-ups didn't demand this kind of promise from kids.
Is it bad what's going on in there?
No, he said. It's good. But these are dangerous times.
Loretta looked into the man's dark eyes. He was intense. A little frightening, perhaps, but alive in a way she hadn't seen before. Here was a man who wouldn't live in a dirty tent and eat scraps and be grateful for it. He wasn't broken like the rest of them. His vitality called out to her, reminded her of better times, of the man she'd thought her father to be.
I promise.
He drove forward, threading his way through the parked cars. Near the doors, he parked the truck and turned off the engine.
You stay in the truck, he said, opening his door.
How long will you be?
As long as I need to be.
Loretta watched him walk toward the barn and open the door. She saw a flash of light and what looked like shadow people gathered within. Then he closed the door behind him. Loretta stared at the dark barn, the streaks of light bleeding through the cracks. What were they doing in there? An automobile chugged up alongside the truck, parked. Its headlights snapped off. Loretta saw a couple get out of the car. They were well-dressed, all in black, both smoking cigarettes. Definitely not migrants or farmers. Loretta made a snap decision. She got out of the truck and followed the couple to the barn. The barn door opened. Loretta slipped in behind the couple and immediately pressed herself back against the rough boards of the barn. She couldn't have said what she was expecting to see, grown-ups drinking hooch and dancing the Lindy Hop, maybe, but whatever she'd expected, it wasn't this. Men dressed in suits mingled with women, some of whom were wearing pants. Pants! They seemed to be all talking at once, gesturing with their hands as if arguing. The place felt alive, hive-like with activity. Cigarette smoke created a haze that blurred everyone and stung Loretta's eyes. There were about 10 tables set up in the barn's dusty, shadowed interior, with lanterns set on each one, creating pockets of light shot through with dust and smoke. Typewriters and mimeograph machines were positioned on the tables. Women sat in chairs and smoked and typed. There was a strange aroma in the air, mixed in with the smell of smoke. Stacks of papers lined the tabletops. Every once in a while, Loretta heard the bring of a carriage return. When Jack strode forward, people stopped what they were doing and turned toward him. He pulled a newspaper off a table in front of him and climbed up several loft steps, then faced the crowd. He lifted the newspaper up. The headline read, "Los Angeles declares war on migrants."
Police Chief James Two Guns Davis, with the support of the big growers, the railroads, the state relief agencies, and the rest of the state fat cats, just closed the California border to migrants.
Jack threw the paper to the straw-covered floor.
Think of it. Desperate people, good people, Americans, are being stopped at the border at gunpoint and turned away. To go where? Many of them are starving back home or dying of dust pneumonia. If they won't turn back, the coppers are jailing them for vagrancy and judges are sentencing them to hard labor.
Laredo was hardly surprised. She knew what it was like to come here looking for better and be treated as worse.
Bastards! Someone yelled. All across the state of California, the big growers are taking advantage of the people who work for them. The migrants coming into the state are so desperate to feed their families, they'll take any wage. There are more than 70,000 homeless people between here and Bakersfield. Children are dying in the squatters' camps at a rate of 2 a day from malnutrition or disease. It's not right. Not in America. I don't care if there is a depression. Enough is enough. It's up to us to help them. We have to get them to join the Workers' Alliance and stand up for their rights.
There was a roar of approval from the crowd. Laredo nodded. His words struck a nerve with her, made her think for the first time, we don't have to take this.
Now is the time, comrades. The government won't help these people. It is up to us. We have to convince the workers to stand up, rise up, use any means at our disposal to stop big business from crushing the workers and taking advantage of them. We must stand together and fight this capitalist injustice. We will fight for the migrant workers here and in the Central Valley, help them organize into unions and battle for better wages. The time is now.
Yes,
Laredo shouted.
Yes.
Jack jumped down from the riser on the loft ladder, but just before he did, Laredo saw him look directly at her. He strode toward her, making his way easily through the crowd. Laredo felt the intensity of his gaze. She felt like a mouse paralyzed by the gaze of a hunting hawk.
I thought I told you to stay in the truck.
I want to join your group. I could help.
Oh, really?
He towered over her, was even taller than her mom. She drew in a tight, ragged breath.
Go home, kid. You're too young for this.
I am a migrant worker.
He lit a cigarette, studied her.
We live in the Ditchbank camp off Sutter Road. I picked cotton this fall when I should have been in school. If I hadn't, we would have starved. We live in a tent. We wanted the jobs in the fields so badly that sometimes we slept in ditches at the side of the road to be first in line. The boss, that fat pig Welty, he doesn't care if we make enough to eat.
Welty, huh? We've been trying to unionize the migrant camps. We've met with resistance. The Okies are stubborn and proud.
Don't call us that, she said. We're people who just want jobs. My grandparents and my mom, they don't believe in government handouts. They want to make it on their own, but...
But what?
Well, it's not going to work, is it? Us coming here for a better life and actually getting it?
Not without a fight.
I want to fight,
Laredo said, realizing as she said it that she'd been itching for this fight for a long time. This was what she'd run away to find, not her lily-livered father. This was the passion she'd lost. She felt the heat of it.
How old are you, really?
13.
And your old man ran out on the family when he lost his job in St. Louis.
Texas,
Laredo said.
Kid, men like that aren't worth shit. And you're too young to be walking around on your own. How'd you get to California?
My mom brought us.
All by herself? She must be tough.
I called her a coward tonight.
He gave her a knowing look.
Is she going to be worried?
Laredo nodded.
Unless they went looking for me. What if they're gone?
At that, homesickness gripped her. Not the kind for a place, but for people. Her people. Mom and aunt, grandma and grandpa, the people who loved her.
Kid, the people who love you stay. You've already learned that. Go find your mom and tell her you've been as dumb as a box of marbles, and let her hold you tight.
Laredo felt the sting of tears. A police siren wailed outside.
Shit,
Jack said, taking her by the arm, dragging her across the barn through the panicking crowd. He shoved her up the ladder in front of him and pushed her into the loft.
There's fire in you, kid. Don't let the bastards put it out. Stay here till morning or you might end up in the hoosegow.
He dropped down the loft ladder to the barn floor. The door cracked open. Cops appeared in the opening, holding guns and billy clubs. Behind them, red lights flashed. Cops streamed into the barn, scooped up the papers and the typewriters and the mimeograph machines. Loretta saw a cop hit Jack in the head with his club. Jack staggered, but didn't fall. Weaving a little, he grinned at the copper.
That's all you got?
The cop's face tightened.
You're a dead man, Valen. Sooner or later.
He hit Jack again, harder.
Round him up, fellas,
the policeman said, as blood splattered his uniform.
We don't want Reds in our town.
Reds. Communists. Elsa walked beneath an anemic moon into the town of Welty. At this hour, the streets were deserted. There it was, the police station, tucked on a side street not far from the library. She didn't believe that anyone in authority would actually help her, or even listen to her, but her daughter was missing. This was all she could think of to do. The parking lot was empty, but for a few cruisers and an old-fashioned truck. In the light cast downward from a street lamp, she saw a bindle stiff standing beside the truck smoking a cigarette. She didn't make eye contact, but felt him watching her. Elsa straightened to her full height, unaware that she'd become hunched on her walk here. She moved past the vagrant and entered the station. Inside, the lobby was austere, one row of chairs against a wall, each one empty. Light shone down from the ceiling onto a man in uniform smoking a hand-rolled cigarette at a desk with a black phone. She tried to look confident. Clutching her fraying handbag strap, she crossed the tile floor, made her way to the officer at the desk. He was tall and thin, with slicked back hair and a thin mustache. He wrinkled his nose at her disheveled appearance. She cleared her throat.
Sir, I'm here to report a missing girl.
She tensed, waited for it. We don't care about your kind.
Uh-huh.
My daughter. She's 13. Do you have children?
He was silent so long she almost turned away.
I do. A 12-year-old, in fact. She's the reason I'm losing my hair.
Elsa would have smiled any other time.
We had a fight. I said... Anyway, she ran away.
Do you have any idea where she'd go? What direction?
Elsa shook her head.
Her father left us a while ago. She misses him, blames me, but we have no idea where he is.
Folks are doing that these days. Last week, we had a fella kill his whole family before he killed himself. Hard times.
Elsa waited for more. The man stared at her.
You won't find her,
Elsa said dully.
How could you?
I'll keep my eye out. Mostly they come back.
Elsa tried to compose herself, but his kindness unraveled her more than cruelty could.
She has black hair and blue eyes. Well, almost violet, really, but she says only I see that. Her name is Loretta Martinelli.
Beautiful name.
He wrote it down. Elsa nodded, stood there a moment longer.
My recommendation is to go home, ma'am. Wait, I bet she'll come back. It's obvious you love her. Sometimes our kids don't see what's right in front of them.
Elsa backed away, unable to even thank him for his kindness. Outside, she stared across the empty parking lot and thought, where is she? Elsa's legs started to give out on her. She stumbled, nearly fell. Someone steadied her.
You okay?
She wrenched sideways, pulled away. He backed off, lifted his hands in the air.
Hey, I'm not going to hurt you.
I'm fine, she said.
I'd say you're further from fine than anyone I've ever met.
It was the bindle stiff she'd seen by the truck on her way into the station. An ugly bruise discolored one of his cheekbones. Dried blood flecked his collar. His black hair was too long, raggedly cut, threaded with gray at the temples.
I'm fine.
You look exhausted. Let me drive you home.
You must think I'm stupid.
I'm not dangerous.
Says the bloodied up man at the police station at 1 in the morning.
He smiled.
A good beating makes him feel better.
What did you do?
Do? You think you need to commit a crime to get beaten up by the coppers? I'm just unpopular these days. Radical ideas,
he said, still smiling.
Let me drive you home. You will be safe with me.
He put a hand to his chest.
Jailbird's honor.
No, thanks.
Elsa didn't like the way he was staring at her. He reminded her of the hungry men who lurked in shadows to steal what they wanted. Deep-set black eyes peered out from his craggy face. He had a jutting nose and pushed-out chin, and he needed a shave.
What are you looking at?
You remind me of someone, that's all. A warrior.
Yeah, I'm a warrior, all right.
Elsa walked away. Out on the main road, she turned left, toward the camp. It was the only thing she could think of to do. Go home. Aunt was there. Wait and hope. 26. After a long, sleepless night in the barn, Loretta climbed down from the loft as dawn turned the sky lavender and then pink and then golden. She walked down the road, carrying her suitcase. At Sutter Road, she looked out at the spray of tents and broken-down automobiles and cobbled-together shacks clustered in the winter-dead field. Please still be here. Loretta stayed away from the muddy ruts and kept to the grassy high ground as she headed for their tent. She passed a hovel built of metal scraps. Inside, a man and woman huddled around a nub of a candle. The woman held a very still baby in her arms. Up ahead, Loretta saw their truck parked by the tent. Her knees almost buckled in relief. Thank God, they were still here. Loretta rounded the truck and saw the Dewey's tent. Mrs. Dewey sat in a chair out front, hunched over, hands curled around a cup of coffee. Mom sat on an overturned apple crate beside her, writing in her journal. Loretta slowed her step, moved quietly forward. In the silence that should have held a baby breathing, Loretta saw how broken both women looked. Jean looked up first, smiled at Loretta, and touched Elsa's arm.
It's your girl. I told you she'd come back.
Mom looked up. Loretta felt a breathtaking rush of love for her mother.
I'm so sorry,
she said. Mom closed her journal and stood up. She tried to smile, and in the failure, Loretta glimpsed the pain she'd caused by running away. Mom stood still, didn't move toward Loretta. Loretta knew this distance between them was hers to cross.
I've been as dumb as a box of marbles, Mom,
Loretta said, moving toward her. A little laugh erupted from her mother. It sounded like joy.
Really? I've been a real crumb to you, Mom, and Loretta, I know you love me, and I'm sorry, Mom. I love you so much.
Mom pulled Loretta into her arms, held her tightly. Loretta clung fiercely to her mother, afraid to let her go.
I was afraid you'd leave when I was gone.
When Mom drew back, her eyes were bright, and she was smiling.
You are of me, Loretta, in a way that can never be broken. Not by words, or anger, or actions, or time. I love you. I will always love you.
She tightened her hold on Loretta's shoulders.
You taught me love. You, first in the whole world, and my love for you will outlive me. If you had not come back... I'm here, Mom, Loretta said. But I learned something last night, and I think it's important.
Elsa grasped Loretta's hand, unable to let go, and let her daughter lead her back to the tent and pull her inside.
I can't wait to tell you where I was, Loretta said as she unbuttoned her coat.
The reunion was over, apparently. Loretta was on to new business. Elsa couldn't help smiling at the quick change in her daughter's demeanor. Elsa sat down on the mattress beside Aunt, who was still sleeping.
Where did you go?
To a communist meeting, in a barn.
Oh, that is hardly what I would have guessed.
I met a man.
Elsa frowned. She started to get up. A man? A grown man? Did he?
A communist.
Loretta sat down beside Elsa.
A whole group of them, really. They were meeting in a barn north of here.